This is Chef John Foles welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, and inviting you to join us at the kitchen table for another hour of adventures in food. Each week, we travel from the back roads of Louisiana to the streets of Europe's capitals, delving into food. We'll talk with chefs, food historians, authors, and producers. We'll search out current trends, revive forgotten traditions, and naturally, we're going to cook with you. The alligator garfish may not be pretty, but they can be ferocious in the water, but as tasso or in a stew, they're just delicious. Join me, Chef John Foles, and Janie Luster of the United Homa Indian Nation as we talk about alligator garfish on Stirring It Up next. But first, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warns Hamas it will pay an intolerable price if it continues to fire rockets at Israel. But as NPR's Soraya Sahardi-Nelson reports from Jerusalem, Netanyahu also suggested Israel will reassess its ground operations once the Israeli army has demolished all Hamas tunnels under the Gaza-Israel border.
Netanyahu says the tunnel search and destroy mission is nearing completion and suggests Israel will reevaluate its military plans once that's done. But he warned Hamas that Israel will fight back if provoked.
And Hamas again will learn the hard way that Israel will do whatever it must do to protect its people.
Meanwhile, relatives of the missing Israeli soldier believed to have been captured by Hamas told reporters they oppose any pullout before he's found. His sister, Ayelet Golden, said dozens of soldiers have died, and if Israel leaves her brother behind, then the operation will have been a failure. Soraya Sahardi-Nelson, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Ohio's governor has declared a state of emergency and is deploying the National Guard to get water to the city of Toledo and other affected areas. As Kabir Bhatia reports from member station WKSU, tests reveal potentially unsafe levels of a toxin that could come from algae in Lake Erie.
Two test samples contained levels of microcystin above the standard for consumption. This comes from a form of algae in bloom on Lake Erie, source of much of the area's water. Toledo city officials are saying not to drink or even touch the water, and boiling will actually increase the toxin's concentration. The warning extends to about 400,000 people in or near the city, an hour west of Cleveland. Most stores near Toledo and over the border in Michigan are out of bottled water or are limiting purchases. The city's zoo and libraries are closed for the day, and city officials are strongly suggesting restaurants close as well. For NPR News, I'm Kabir Bhatia.
One American infected with the Ebola virus is back in the U.S. for treatment. Dr. Kent Brantley arrived on a special plane from West Africa and is now in special isolation at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta. Dr. Jay Varkey, infectious disease specialist, says there's no risk to the public.
We have a process in place that goes from both the air ambulance transportation into the hospital that keeps patients completely separate from all other bedded inpatient units and separate from the public at large.
Another American, Nancy Whitebull, a missionary in Africa, is expected to arrive at the hospital in a few days. Those two Americans worked for North Carolina-based aid group Samaritan's Purse and U.S.-based SIM at a Liberian hospital that treated Ebola patients. Liberia is one of three West African countries hit by the largest Ebola outbreak in history. This is NPR News in Washington. Late last night, House Republicans passed legislation in two bills addressing the crisis on the U.S.-Mexican border. The first bill sends money to provide more security at the U.S. border. The second dials back a program letting immigrants, brought to the U.S. illegally as children, stay here. President Obama condemned the move, saying the bills would not pass the Senate and that without Congress's help, he will act unilaterally as best as he can. Pro football is adding seven new members to the NFL Hall of Fame tonight. Among the inductees, the first punter to be honored. NPR's Tom Coldman has more on the roster of nominees.
Undoubtedly, the NFL will be glad to turn attention away from the Ray Rice domestic violence controversy and to the annual event honoring past heroes. This year's group includes defensive stars Derek Brooks, Michael Strahan, Aeneas Williams, and Claude Humphrey, wide receiver Andre Reed, and offensive tackle Walter Jones. The seventh member is former Oakland punter Ray Guy. Punters can be critically important, but often are dismissed as not being real football players. Not so with Guy, says his former Raider Raiders coach John Madden. "I just didn't let him play," Madden was quoted as saying. "He was too valuable as a punter." ESPN reports 20 other punters are in Canton, Ohio for the ceremony honoring Guy. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Repairs are almost finished on the nearly 100-year-old water main that burst in Los Angeles, dumping 20 million gallons of water on the UCLA campus. Now workers have to fill a giant sinkhole that appeared when the pipe erupted Tuesday. No serious injuries, but many cars were swamped. Hundreds of cars and parking garages were impacted, and also the new floor of the Pauley Pavilion was ruined. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Inada, crafting shiatsu massage chairs for over 50 years, and makers of the DreamWave Total Body Massage Chair at dreamwavechair.com.
Y'all, Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to the kitchen table. Welcome to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. And I want to begin by saying hello to Michelle York, our executive producer. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Been doing a little traveling, finishing up a little television, you know, doing a little
Yeah, you remember radio. Me? I was one chauffeuring you.
Yeah, I remember now that you mentioned. I've been so exhausted, I kind of forget who's in the automobile. It just seems like chatter to me back then.
Is that right? Yeah, right.
And then, of course, across the glass wall, Dean Slama, our engineer. Slama, you know, you don't want to have Michelle as a taskmaster. You know, she's like relentless.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, I don't want to do that right now. You can't do that right now. I don't feel like doing that. Why don't you go ahead and read this? And about 5 minutes later, she lets you rest, and then you can put your head down. Then she say, "You ready to read it now?" "No, I'm not ready to read it now. Get away from me." You know, then she keeps on and keeps on and keeps on. But Slama, she knows when I get ready to do it, it'd be done right.
It's just that he'll decide to do it the morning we're leaving and then wonder why it's not on the teleprompter when we arrive.
That's television.
That's
anyway, yeah. Look, we're having a lot of fun with our PBS series. Our new show is on fishing. We've been all over the Gulf and everywhere else. We're going to talk about that a little bit more. But what's going on, Michelle?
I tell you, it's been hectic and, like you said, a little exhausting, but it's been a lot of fun. Been a whirlwind with the LPB crew, and now we're getting ready to start the, well, I call it the studio portion. We've done all the field work, but the studio portion is still going to be outside. It's just going to be outside at White Oak on the lake. So
yeah, building a big pier out there on the lake to put
it better
my
be ready
set.
By Monday.
It's got to be ready, huh?
Well, I'm saying
some things I control, you know. Anyway, no, I agree. We've had a great time. We've had great guests. You know, it's so easy to find great guests in Louisiana when you're trying to do a show, because there's so many people within all these different genres that are such great experts, and they're all so articulate. They all have different
passionate.
Accents. They're passionate, and they all have these different wonderful accents. They come from different towns. Some are fishermen, some are crabmen. You know, there's all kinds. Some are fishing garfish. Others are doing red snapper. I mean, it's just amazing how just the diversity of the people of this great state and how welcoming they are, too. I've always said, I've been doing PBS since 1989, and I always say that every community of this great state, every house, every person that we've called upon has said, "Come on in."
Yeah.
So that's
yeah,
really great. And I appreciate it, too. So anyway, I'm just sitting back reminiscing on some of my good ones, too.
Well, you know, and each one is like picking a favorite child, right? How can you do that? Each one has merits of its own. One that's particularly kind of standing out to me today is the Alligator Gar show that we did.
Oh, yeah.
Some weeks ago.
Alicia, yeah.
Yeah, Alisa Ferrara from Nicholls State University. She's the garfish expert and, you know, gets in there with all these
prehistoric fish with two rows of teeth.
Yeah, don't mind biting you. And all the research that she's doing, I mean, she is so passionate about alligator gar. And then you go from Alisa to Janie Luster. And we've known Janie Luster many years now. She represents the United Homa Nation, and she actually cooked garfish tasso for us. And that was the first time that I have ever had that, and it was absolutely delicious. And I know that you love being able to use underutilized meats or fish, and there are a lot of virtues of this fish to extol. In fact, I think gar may be one of your favorites in this category.
Well, you know, there are so many underutilized species in Louisiana, and the reason for it is because we have so many species. I mean, the Gulf and the swamplands and the freshwater and the brackish water allow us so many different varieties of fish and shellfish that normally we go for the easier thing to do. But when you walk into a Native American community and you meet a Janie Luster and you meet chiefs of the United Homa Nation, and they are more about sustainability and they're more about using the cultural aspects of food. And to bring out a 6-foot gar that weighs 100 pounds and it looks like a monster from the deep, and to see how beautiful the meat is and how to make the boulettes and cook it in tomato sauce and put it on spaghetti, and to make tasso, the smoked spicy meat, seasoning meat for vegetables and all. It's absolutely, absolutely incredible. And no one can make it better than the Native Americans, because that's what they did. They smoked to preserve meat, and they smoked to preserve the meat of the garfish. And, of course, it became a seasoning meat. So, yeah, it was absolutely fantastic.
Well, and her recipe has been handed down through generations of her Homa Indian family. So she's doing her part to really continue the tradition, educate this generation's palates, and introduce everyone to the culture. Very interesting flavors. And this fish, at least 100 million years old.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it roamed with the dinosaurs. Yeah.
It did. So they're members of the spatula species. And if you remember in our encyclopedia book, those early French explorers actually drew what they saw. So they drew pictures of fish and they drew pictures of deer. And there's a spatula fish. Do you remember that?
I remember very well, sure.
The flat, long head. And so, I mean, you can clearly see where spatula comes from. And as for the alligator part of alligator gar, well, you see the resemblance in the head. And they're practically armored in the same way. It is amazing. Instead of the fish scales, the gars have overlapping diamond-shaped scales. They're hard, they're bony, kind of an enamel-like surface, practically impenetrable by standard fishing methods.
Well, and that's why they've been here for a couple million years. They can protect themselves and
they can
live in the swamplands, yeah.
Hard scales, and Native Americans actually use the scales as arrowheads or as breastplates, and today they use those scales. Janie makes beautiful artwork in brooches and pins and out of the garfish scales.
Remember those gorgeous crosses she had made?
Oh,
she's got
beautiful.
These Christian crosses with the scales and painted. I mean, they're just beautiful. And they really are tough, though, these gigantic fish. Over 7 feet long, some of them weighing hundreds of pounds. Just a couple of months back, a pre-med student from Nicholls State University was taken on a wild ride by a 215-pound garfish he shot with his bow. It pulled him in his boat all around Lake Boudreaux until the fish finally tired out.
I can believe
it. Oh, absolutely. And another one was caught in Texas on Memorial Day weekend a year or so ago. 300 pounds, 8 feet long, and most people thought that it would be about 100 years old, this fish, gigantic. Again, it was shot with a bow in the head, and to make it stop dragging the fishermen through the water took a couple of hours to make that happen. Just like fishing the great large salmon of the Northwest. Once you hook them, you better be ready to go. You know, you're going to fight
well,
it for a while.
I mean, that's
or
like
tuna.
Like the tuna fishing. The first time I went and had the belt strapped on, and I'm thinking, well, I need this. What, my arms are going to get tired of holding the pole? No, that's to keep you from going overboard to strap you in. I mean, that's pretty scary stuff. But the alligator gar, it's no wonder it's called the monster fish on Animal Planet. And as if the size and the scales aren't formidable enough, as you mentioned, the gar have two rows of teeth, a shorter row on the outside and long, slender, fang-like teeth on the inner row that allow them to grab onto their prey and hold it. But despite this feature, they're really not an aggressive fish and will lay very still in the water waiting for lunch or dinner to kind of come within their reach. They're somewhat nocturnal, too, and at night, often they'll even go after small mammals. and turtles and waterfowl that are floating on the top of the water. Isn't that amazing? They eat ducks.
Well, alligator,
a fish. That, yeah. You know, I mean, think about that. It's big enough to eat a duck.
Well, they're huge. And again, think about it, survival. The dinosaurs have been gone for a million years, but the fish is still here. Mm-hmm. And they can stay out of water for a certain amount of time. You know, for decades, the alligator gar was considered a nuisance fish and a predator and was targeted for elimination to protect other game fish. Thousands upon thousands were slaughtered. Then in 1995, a television documentary called Alligator Gar, Predator or Prey, debuted on national PBS. It focused on just the life cycle of the gar fish and addressed the destruction of the habitat and the unregulated harvesting, which was threatening this unbelievable species. It received tremendous attention and got the ball rolling to avoid total annihilation. In the mid-60s, 8 southern states partnered with the Missouri Department of Conservation in a restoration and management effort to preserve the garfish. Fortunately, things are going in the right direction now. The perception of alligator gar as a predator has been replaced with that of a sports fish and dinner.
That's
which
right.
I like a lot.
You can even go to the local fish markets, and alligator gar is filleted and spread out on the ice for you to do what you want with it, alligator tossing.
Again, you're hearing us use this term, underutilized species. At one point in time, the Native Americans would have considered garfish to be the predominant fish in the pots, in the stew pots, or in the soup pots, or in the, as we mentioned a while ago, the bullet for grinding it up, chopping it up, and making meatballs or patties out of it and frying it. Or, as you also mentioned, smoking it and making a tasso, a flavored meat that would be used to flavor vegetables, or because it is a really, really wonderful white meat. A fish, though hard to get to through the scales and the mammoth size of the fish. But at the same time, I mean, we've come to realize that these underutilized species are underutilized because there's so many other fish available. They're easier to catch, they're easier to clean, and we've just let some of these really great, great flavorful fish go by the wayside. And now today, thank God, through some of the, well, just talking about it today on our show, we certainly make people aware of it, and we certainly bring the history of that fish back to the, we actually love garfish. I mean, we used to catch a lot of garfish in the bar pit ponds on the river. We lived right on the river as young boys. The bayous were teeming with garfish, so we always had a lot of it, and it had multiple purposes. Yes, we used it as a bait fish, but at the same time, I can
use that as a bait fish.
As a bait fish, sure. Well, you could put it in shrimp boxes in the river, the freshwater shrimp. We would use it in the river, but mainly it was used in camp cooking. The trappers and the hunters, my dad was a trapper, and the trappers and the hunters always enjoyed the fact that they were easy to catch, and you could do a lot with them. So naturally, they made their way into most of the cast iron pots of the Cajuns as well. Anyway, y'all, we're going to take a quick break. We have a great guest coming up, and you don't want to miss it. We're talking garfish today. We're going to talk about some other underutilized species that I love, but it's all about garfish today, and we have a great guest with us. You want to be right here with us as well.
Finest in classic ska, rocksteady, rockers, DJ, dancehall, and dub, it's Jamon. Cecil here, bringing you Southwest Louisiana's longest-running reggae tradition, Jamon. Jamon, Sunday nights from 9 to 11 p.m., or Saturday mornings from 1 to 3 a.m., and streaming live anytime at krvs.org.
Greetings. I'm Jake Hebert.
And I'm Adam Chouard. Join us every Friday at midnight for the Sound Club radio program.
Your home for left field pop gems from today to yesteryear.
Here on 88.7 FM KRVS.
Hi, I'm Pete Bergeron. If your day starts early, like mine does, let's spend it together with Cajun music from 5 to 7 a.m. here at Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Well, I saw my baby walking with another man today. Well, I saw my baby walking with another man today. When I asked her what's the matter, this is what I heard her say. See you later, alligator. After a while, crocodile.
Everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting food and culture show on radio. It's so nice to have all of you with us today. I know you have a lot of choices to make, and you chose us, so thank you so much for being with us, Michelle. We're talking about Garfish. We're talking about a lot of great things, cultural and historic in Louisiana, and today we have the most important guest to talk about the subject we're talking about, garfish and some of these underutilized species. Why don't you go ahead and introduce her?
Absolutely. Our good friend Janie Verrett Luster is with us today. Janie, as we were mentioning earlier, is a Native American, member of the United Houma Nation, and is a citizen of the United Houma Nation whose parents were both traditional Houma artists. Janie grew up in the Houma Indian community of Bayou de Large, where she continues to live today with her husband, been married 37 years, five great children, grandchildren now. Janie is a well-known Houma artist in her own right. We were talking about some of her artwork earlier.
Beautiful
with garfish
stuff.
Scales.
Beautiful stuff, yeah.
She also practices the art of traditional basket weaving. And I think this is so spectacular. Janie is actually responsible for reintroducing the Houma half stitch, which is a method of basketry taught to her by the late Richard Kahn. And Richard was the former chief curator of Native Arts at the Denver Museum of Art. So now Janie, she has kind of reignited this passion and is sharing the Houma half hitch with her community, but with the community of all of us at large. Janie serves on the tribal council. She's been doing that since 2008. She represents the lower Dulac and lower Bayou de Large communities. And Janie, it is so good to have you with us again on Stirring It Up. It's been a while.
Well, thank you, Michelle, for inviting me. It's so good to be with both you and John this morning.
Janie, I want to, first of all, welcome you too, but say a gigantic thank you for all the work you did with us as we roll through Louisiana shooting our new PBS series. And as I've done since 1989 when we started shooting our PBS series, we've always come your way and come to the Houma Nation for sure. And y'all were always there with open arms, as you were just recently as well when we came over to cook garfish and it was just a wonderful, wonderful experience. I just wanted to publicly thank you for all of that. And I also wanted to ask a little bit about the basket while it's on my mind since Michelle mentioned the half hitch. Are you making those, and are they for sale anywhere, or are you just starting it up? Because I'd certainly like to pick up one of those from a collection. I'd like to buy one from my collection if they are being made right now. I do have the Cachada Long Needle Pine Basket, but I don't have a Houma half hitch.
We still making them. Like I say, we were really fortunate to be able to bring this back because it was completely lost. We couldn't even find them in the communities. At that time, when we were searching, we found memories. Elders had good memories but couldn't tell us how it was woven together. And so that's where Miss Oradell Morris, she had written the book, J'entends la chanson des Houmas, or I Hear the Song of the Houmas, and she found our baskets in the museums. And that was the connection with Mr. Richard Kahn. When she released her book, she was able to bring him down to do a one-day workshop. and I had attended just to look on. But then after several weeks of being exposed to this, we called to see who was actually weaving, and everyone had given up. It was too hard. And so my friend and I, Miss Corrine Falk, she says, "But Janie," and I know when that "But Janie" comes in, I knew she was up to something. And so, you know, knowing the importance of having the opportunity to bring this back to the tribe, I knew that I had to, you know, try my hand at it. It didn't actually work right off the bat. I had to do a lot of praying, you know, to the Creator and to my ancestors. If they had the gift, please to pass it on. And it was passed on. And so now I have Miss Laurie Ann Chasson, which y'all know, and Louise Billiard and Cheryl Parfait. And my daughter Anne was the first traditional weaver of this basket since the early 40s. So I'm very proud of that. And now, you know, these ladies have gone into the community also to teach this form of basket weaving. So it's coming back. It's never going to be mass produced, but, you know, it's there. And hopefully, you know, it stays with us this time and we don't lose it.
What makes this basket special? What makes it different from, say, other Native American baskets?
Well, we were the only tribe in the whole country to make this basket. It's very unique. It's all palmetto, which, you know, grows down here. And it's a one-step process, in a sense, with the weaves that came forth after this one was lost. You would have to braid the palmetto and then go back and sew it. And this one, you don't sew it at all. It's just a technique. You make a half-inch knot every time you weave, and that's, you know, that forms a whole basket.
Wow, wow. And are there any of them for sale anywhere, or is there any being made that?
Well, I'm going to do a special order, and one of the things that I do is the turtle basket. So I'm going to have you on my list for turtle basket.
Well, you better hurry up. I got a PBS show coming up. I need a turtle basket. So you better get all the girls together. Y'all better have a what do you call that when all the women get together?
A weaving party.
A weaving,
I guess.
Party. Whatever you're going to
call. A half hitch party.
That's it. And all my girls, all three girls, can weave this basket.
All
and,
right. See, that, we're on a roll now.
We're on a roll because we have a second generation also.
That's
the
great.
Granddaughters are weaving this basket.
Oh, all. Wow. That's fantastic. That's great.
Well, we met your grandson out there, and I tell you, what a little rascal. I fell in love with him.
Oh, that RJ, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. What a sweetheart.
Jane, anyway, yeah, we'll continue to talk, and we look forward to having y'all when we do begin taping the new PBS series soon. But always, again, a special thanks for all that you do for us. Now, let's talk a little bit about your role. Tell us the extent of the United Home and Nation now. Where is it located? A little bit about the tradition, just so our listeners will know what we're talking about when we talk about your culture.
We are a sovereign nation, and so we have a tribal government, and we have 11 council members that serve on the tribal government. And I represent Lord Dulang and Lord Dulorge. And, you know, one of the main things that we are fighting for right now is federal recognition. And at this point right now, in fact, last Tuesday, we were meeting for the federal regulations as far as the process. You know, the process of federal recognition has been broken. We've been at this for over 30 years, and so now they're looking to redo the process, and hopefully it goes through that it makes it a little bit easier for tribes like ourselves that have been up there for so many years to go through the process and be acknowledged as a federal tribe.
What happened that you lost that identity as a federal tribe, or was you were never recognized? Why would the Homa not be recognized as a federal tribe?
Well, because we're always so peaceful. That was our problem. We never went to war with anyone, so we never had a treaty. And, you know, when the French came in, we welcomed them with open arms. You know, they recognize us as a tribe, but our own government does not.
So when the French arrived in Louisiana in the late 1600s and founded New Orleans in the 1720s, the Houma were a great asset to the French coming in, but yet today not recognized as a tribe. That's incredible.
It is. It is. And we still have a good relationship with the French. In fact, we are working with them at this point. They want to come in to build us a culture center that would house also a French immersion school. We are searching to buy land. We have to buy the land. You know, we only have a small piece of property down in Montague that we have an old Indian school. And so we're seeking to be able to buy land in the northern part of Terrebonne Parish, you know, avoiding the flood area.
Right, right.
And we're just going to be away from the Indian communities, but in a sense, a good thing for the fact that this culture center, if we ever have a hurricane, we could also use that as an area that we can have contact with our people.
And y'all still speak French today. As we were listening to communication on the bayou that day, it was like, oh, my gosh.
Oh, yes.
That's
we call it a Houma French because there's still some Houma words that are being used.
Mm-hmm.
But the French that we speak, a lot of times people want to say it's Cajun, but it's not. It's the old world French. And still, you know, old world, I didn't realize how old it was until I went to France myself and spoke with some of the elders over there and then come back over here also speaking to some of the French people that's here. And some of the words, yeah, for a pin, I would call it un plume, which is a feather. Mm-hmm. But that goes back to the early days when they were using the feather as a writing instrument. And one lady says, I hadn't heard that since my mother was living.
Is that a good example? Is there any other? Because when I was listening to y'all talk amongst yourselves, I noticed immediately that there were words that were unrecognizable to me in French. But I realized y'all were speaking French between you. And all of a sudden, there were words that would come up I didn't understand. Is there a good example of that for our listener? Something that you just mentioned, plume, for pen, which, of course, is feather in French, but certainly a writing instrument in the language because they were using any other good examples of that we might recall?
Well, one of the things that I'm realizing now, our language is slowly disappearing as we know it or have known it for the 100 years or so that we've been using it. And with the Houma language mixed in, a lot of times, you know, if you're talking about fishing, you're going to hear the word patasa, which is the word, a Houma word for perch. And then I can remember as a child when the French people would come and visit with my parents, my older brother, Kirby Verrett, would come out at the time he was taking French in high school. He would come out with his French and English dictionary and would ask the French people, how do you say raccoon in French? Well, they had their word, and our word was chawi, which a lot of times, you know, through the years was mistaken as a Cajun word. But indeed, it is a Houma Indian word.
I always thought chawi was a French word for raccoon, but it's a Native American word. We use the word chawi for coon as well.
Uh-huh.
Well, I'll be doggone. See,
and
that
it's like I say, you know, just like we say the Cajuns have a broken French.
Right.
I find that with the young French people, it's also broken because the other thing that happened when I went to France, we had a couple people that came down to meet with us from the New Orleans area. So I figured the lady would need to use the bathroom. And so I'm asking her if she wanted to use La Chambre au Bain. And she kind of looked at me kind of funny, didn't understand what I was talking about. So I proceeded to use the other word, commode, and she still looked at me. So by that time, we started walking towards the restroom area, and when we got to it, she says, oh, la toilette.
La toilette.
And to me, that's English.
La toilette, la lavabo, is the wash pan.
Uh-huh.
Now, one of the things that we definitely want to talk about is preservation of old ways and et cetera. And one of the things that you're so well known for is the art of using the scales of the garfish. We certainly made the beautiful garfish tasso, which is the meat we've been talking about, used, and y'all did a great job of flavoring it and smoking it for us. And I think it was your nephew or relative who brought in all of the beautiful garfish, these monster fish, and brought them in for us to use that day. But you are actually using the scales of that garfish to prepare unbelievable artwork. And how did that get started? Has that been a tradition, or is that something that you created yourself?
I call it a family tradition because my mom was making them in the early 1940s. We were a trapping family, and so we would leave a home on the bayous on Bayou du Lorge and go out to one of the lakes where we had a fishing camp, and Mama wanted flowers for her camp. And she would take the tag grass, the fat mud, the gray clay, as we call it.
Right, right.
And form a ball and put those garfish scales to form her flower. And she would also use the redfish or drum scales, and she would pierce a hole in them, like maybe with a nail, and then she would take a needle and thread and sew these together.
Hmm.
And so I always say, Mama, anything she put her hands on that she could make flowers, she would. And that's where the story also came from her about Native American people using them as arrow points also.
I was going to ask you about that, other uses for parts of the garfish. I mean, maybe the teeth, not just the scales. Are there traditions such as that, Janie?
Oh, yeah. Like I said, you know, the scales themselves can be used as arrow points, but there's also a bone in the head that makes the perfect spear point.
Mm.
And that spear point also on the top of it, if you pass your hand on it, it feels like a file effect.
Right.
And I said, you know, it probably was used as a file. I said, you know, probably when back in those days had calluses also.
Yeah, yeah. What about the, you know, we've talked about the garfish tasso, but can you kind of describe that meat for us and what else you use the garfish for?
The meat, it's kind of a white, dry meat, I would say, and a cross between the alligator and fish. It doesn't really taste like chicken like everybody says. I think it's a cross between alligator and fish. It really doesn't have that fishy smell. It's more a little of the alligator smell combined with a little fish smell to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, one of the things that I grew up with, you know, was Mama would take it and make some boulettes, you know.
I like meatballs or patties, right?
Correct, uh-huh. And then also the garden nuggets, as we call them. Now, my cousin Ricky that I get, Ricky Verrett, that he's the one that brought the garfish, and he's one of our traditional fishermen. He's always fished garfish. His dad fished that, and so that's another tradition with his family. He likes to cook just, you know, the filet of garfish with a little butter. And you might, you know, just put salt and pepper and maybe a little bit of garlic in it and pan fry it. And that's very good.
Well, the meat is so wonderful. I mean, to imagine a fish the size of an alligator gar that's got a head of an alligator, scales that are used for arrowheads, millions of years on the earth, but yet to find such a wonderful, delicate meat that can be used in so, so many different areas. Keeping that tradition alive has certainly been a wonderful part of the Native American culture. And also, I think what I have such great respect for is the way you and your family and also the Homa tribe themselves, how they have just sustaining these foodways and sustaining the arts and the crafts, as you say, going out to recreate the baskets that were lost and finding a way to continue these traditions. Janie, we're going to take a quick little break, and I'm going to ask you to stay over just for a minute so we can talk a little bit more about some of the things that y'all are doing as a Native American group here in Louisiana. So I appreciate you being with us. Y'all, don't go anywhere. We have a lot of great things we're going to continue to chat about with Janie Luster of the United Homa Nation. We'll be back in a minute.
Fish ain't biting. Fish ain't biting. Fish ain't biting round in no more. Well, fish ain't biting. Fish ain't biting no more.
When you hear the word lambada, is the first thing you think of the Amazon? No. Well, it should be. Hello, I'm Georges Collinet. Join me as we dive into the hot sounds of the Brazilian Amazon. Next time on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
Hi everyone, this is Pat Mitchell-Worley, and coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan, we've got Mingo Fishtrap and the Monophonics, two young soul acts that we really think you're going to like. We'll also hear from our feature host, Adam Hill, as he continues his series, Made in Memphis. That's all coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan.
Tonight at 11 on KRVS.
Comics avec Val. Bienvenue dans le monde francophone. C'est tous les jeudis à 9h sur KRVS, la radio Acadie.
Explore the wide range of musics from throughout the world every week here on Earthbeat. I'm Cecil Doyle, bringing you classics, field recordings, and the latest sounds spanning the globe. That's Earthbeat, Sunday nights at 7 p.m., Thursday evenings at 10 p.m. here on KRVS.
Tell you what, I don't know who wrote that song about Alligator Gar, but it sounds like he's with one right now. Huh? I never knew they had a song about Alligator Gar, but there it is. Hey, welcome back, everybody, to Stirring It Up, the best tasting and cultural show on radio. Where else are we going to be talking in America to a member of the United Home of Nation about a prehistoric fish and its use in artwork? Where else but right here on Stirring It Up? And we thank you all so much for being with us today. And thank Janie Luster for being with us as well. So, Michelle?
Janie, I was just wondering, I love hearing your stories and the traditional stories, and particularly the culinary traditions. I know one time you told us about the food preservation and even about evaporating salt. Would you mind sharing some of those culinary traditions with our audience?
Well, you know, again, with the salt, my mom talked about early spring, people would gather around the Gulf and take the salt water from the Gulf, and they would put that in a big pot, and it would evaporate, and then you would be left with the salt, and they would collect that. And then the other thing with the garfish, you know, she would salt it down, sun-dry it, put it on a clothesline, and also smoke it. And, you know, I've seen that as a child. I remember she would do this, you know, early spring when the weather was nice and dry. And she would put that on the clothesline, you know. And then I can remember we got our first freezer from a couple from New Orleans. But yet, you know, that was the form of preserving, salting something down and, you know, smoking it. It, you could keep it like that. But when we got that freezer, Mama still did the same thing and put her garfish in bags and put them in the freezer just like that.
Well, being that it was such a huge shrimping tradition in your area as well, did she dry shrimp or do any special things with other fish or seafood?
Oh, yeah. She dried the shrimp. We always call it shrimp candy. My kids grew up with that. And in the same matter, especially, you know, when the shrimp, the harvest was small, you would always ball that and, you know, dry it in the sun, put that My mom would also make the filet. It's another thing that she was known for. And again, you know, we've seen the changes that have come through the years. And long before, you know, there was talk about the saltwater intrusion, my mom knew something was going on. You know, we flooded many times with hurricanes, Bessie, Camille, and we always had some sassafras trees in our yard. And that was one of the first signs that she saw that the trees were dying, and she knew it was the salt water. And today, there's no more sassafras trees in my area because of that salt water that's come in over the years.
You mentioned sassafras, which is really another great Native American tradition and a gift given to the French. The sassafras, or filet powder, as we call it, was not only given to us as a flavoring ingredient, it has a thickening component to it, like, say, arrowroot or cornstarch or something like that. But the Native Americans had many uses for it. You use it as a thickener in the shrimp filet gumbo that you taught me how to make using the seawater and using the filet to thicken it. But also, wasn't it used medicinally? Wasn't it used as a medicine as well?
Yes, the roots were also used. And they would make a tea out of that.
Well, I remember hearing the stories about how the Native Americans used the filet to kind of pack on wounds or on scrapes or cuts, that it was also had great healing remedies to it as well. And I tell you, we've lost so many of those unbelievable traditions. How are you maintaining those in the community? How do you continue to pass those down as the rest of America throws so much of our past away? How is the home of community keeping those traditions alive?
By speaking of it and still practicing them. You know, my mom and my dad both used the plants, and that was one of the things that I learned. And I can remember learning the plants by their names in French. And at one time, I really had a big problem with that. But yet, both my parents have passed on now, and I realized the value of their information. I have the French names, and now, you know, I can go into books and find what they are in English, but I can no longer go to them and ask, what is this, what is it used for? And like I say, I just value their information that they passed on to me. And my parents were both traditional people, and they made sure that they passed on what they knew. In Montague, we have a small strip of land that we have gardens that, you know, identify our plants that we use. As far as, you know, for medicines and for food and things like that.
Janie, there's a long tradition of having treaters in the Native American and French community. Is that an active part of the Houma Nation?
It is. It's slowly, we're seeing it slowly. You know, it's hard to find a treater today. I find myself, you know, even Laurianne, I can remember several years back, she called me in the midst of winter. She had a little niece that was teething, and so she wanted the plant that was good for a baby. She says, would you make me a necklace? And so I find sometimes people come to me, and I don't regard myself as a traiteur, but people are coming to me for advice, you know, what to use. And so, like I said, in the wintertime, all these plants, you can't find them. They don't have the leaf on them. But yet, I have an Indian mound not too far from my house, and my husband and I went out there, and he says, how are you going to find this? I said, well, you know, I'm going to find it. And as we walked around, we were walking on what we call La Bomalu, and I could smell it. And I said, let's dig right here. And sure enough, the root was right there. And so I proceeded to collect the roots and wash them, and I made a necklace for that little baby. And the story behind that is that you make that necklace and it draws the fever from the child's body. And if, you know, the root is about the size of your little finger, you put that at night on that baby, and in the morning that root's going to be dried up because it, you know, would have drawn the fever from the body of the baby.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, I said, that's incredible. You were mentioning the sassafras a minute ago, and the trees disappearing from your area. I remember my grandfather taking us into the woods with a little hatchet, and we would chop a little bit of the root of the sassafras tree, bring it into the house, boil it in water, add brown sugar to it, and of course that was the origin of root beer.
Uh-huh.
And we made root beer all the time, and then he would take the wood that had been boiled, and you could boil it over and over and over again because it was always still full flavor with all that cinnamon and nutmeg and allspice flavor that you take in root beer, that you get in root beer. But he would use the wood to smoke meat, too, and that sassafras smoke was just incredible. So anyway, Jane, it's been just really great talking to you. I also want to thank you personally for being with us just recently on when we had the chaîne de rôtisserie, the chain of the rôtisserie from around the United States and the world. It's a major gourmet society of individuals who still practice the art of fine dining and good wine. And we exhibited the seven nations and the foods of the seven nations that created Louisiana's Creole cuisine. And you were so generous to come in your beautiful native outfit and address the crowd in one of the dishes that we were serving that night, representing the Native American culture. And what a great, great job y'all did that night. So thank you so much for being there with us as well.
Oh, we enjoyed it. Thank you for having us. We felt like celebrities. People were taking our pictures left and right, me and Laurianne Chasson.
You were the celebrity that night, and along with the other six nations represented, the Germans, the French, the Italians, the Africans. I mean, it was really a lot of fun. Even Michelle stood up and did the French, because our French person got ill that night, and Michelle had to step in and did a beautiful job with the French traditions. Look, so we look forward to having you on our PBS series when we start shooting at White Oak Plantation. So if y'all get busy and get my turtle basket done, we're going to present it on national television. So I appreciate it, and I will make a generous contribution to the Native American culture, Bahamas, because of that basket. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Good. Dora.
Don't you just love J.D. Lester?
I love J.D.
I mean all the traditions that she shares, and I was just thinking, you know, J.D. is so busy, but I hope she's writing that down because it's history.
Yeah.
I mean, and we all share in that history, home and nation or not, you know, all part of our heritage. But yeah, books on the subject. The first book I want to recommend is Season of the Gar, Adventures in Pursuit of America's Most Misunderstood Fish. It was written by Mark Spitzer. The author is actually an assistant professor of writing at the University of Central Arkansas, and he's an avid fisherman. Season of the Gar combines his talents as a writer and his passion for fishing, and especially fishing for gar. In this, you know, sometimes scary, sometimes funny book about the garfish, he explains its history, its prehistoric roots, and actually the dangers of, he doesn't call it fishing gar, but of hunting gar. I guess you could go either way on that with that monster fish. The author was also featured on the episode of Animal Planet's River Monsters as a guest and a guide for gar fishing. In addition to all the knowledge you'd ever want about this ancient fish, there are also a great number of recipes in there as well. And then the next book that I think you all will find interesting is Fishing for Buffalo, A Guide to the Pursuit and Cuisine of Carp, Suckers, Eel Pout, Gar, and Other Rough Fish.
Wow.
It was written by Rob Buffler and Tom Dixon. And just as the author says, this is a book about the rough fish, the non-trout, the non-bass, or redfish, or catfish, the type that for so long had been considered trash fish by fish snobs. But fortunately, the stigma is being lifted for these fish as people are learning that they're not only fun and challenging to catch, but delicious to eat as well. So the author gives us a few lessons, a good bit of background information on the fish, and both great books, great additions to your culture and culinary library.
Well, we always want to make sure that you go to our website. If you go to jfalls.com and you go to Stirring It Up, the radio show, you will always find our list of facts, figures, our podcast, everything that has to do with the shows. What else on Facebook? Anything, Slama?
Yeah, that's our Facebook page, facebook.com/stirringitupradio. We encourage our stovehounds to get on up and let us know what you'd like to hear about. We're always posting some pictures. We've got a couple premium Facebook accounts out there about the restaurant and the radio show. But you can check out this program at Stirring It Up Radio after the Facebook.com.
Well, you know, also, I have a couple of good recipes today, but since I think we would talk about garfish tasso, you can actually make tasso with other fish meat as well. But if you just happen to walk into a fish market that has garfish, you can certainly make this tasso. If not, if you get redfish or you get something else and you want to make the tasso, you can. And here's the recipe. You want me to give it to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Janie said that the dried shrimp, they always called shrimp candy.
Shrimp candy. Oh.
I think you could call the alligator gar tasso candy as
fish
well.
Candy
because
as well.
I mean, you can just pop those in your mouth. She uses it to season her gumbo and beans and everything else.
You heard she said garfish nuggets.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
Well, yeah, because you season them so well, you can put cane syrup or brown sugar on them and put them on the grill to smoke as well. And of course, they're going to be great. I use 4 pounds. Of garfish fillets, which you can get in most fish markets in Louisiana, but use any other fish as well. Nice textured fish. In a bowl, I put 1/2 cup of Worcestershire sauce, 1 tablespoon of Louisiana hot sauce, 1/4 cup of cayenne pepper, Michelle, 1/4 cup, 1/4 cup of cracked black pepper, see, very spicy, 1/4 cup of salt, and of course, you can reduce your pepper if you wish, and 1/2 cup of granulated garlic. And by the way, the recipe is on our website, so if you go there, you're going to find it. Also, I add 1/2 cup of brown sugar or syrup if I want to make it nice and sweet and to make the candy out of it. I place the garfish on a baking pan, and then, of course, I cover it with all of those nice spices, or I dip it in that bowl of all of those ingredients that I just mentioned, the sugar and the Worcestershire sauce and the pepper sauce, the garlic, granulated garlic, I should mention. Not garlic powder either, y'all. Granulated garlic, Michelle, is that sandy-looking grain that is a dehydrated garlic that's been ground or chopped. So y'all, you want to put the fish in all of those ingredients that I gave you in a bowl and cover it with a little plastic wrap. Some people let it sit overnight. I think about 4 or 5 hours is enough. Then I put it in my home-style smoker at 175 degrees. I don't cook it too fast. And I let it smoke over some really good smoke wood like pecan or white oak or one of those really nice Louisiana woods, even sassafras wood or blackberry vine as the Native Americans did. And I let it cook for about 3 hours until it's nice and cooked. If you put the sugar on it, you may even want to cook it a little longer. Once it's cooked, of course, and once it's smoked, you can use it to season vegetables and beans. If you have a lot of sugar on it, you may want to use it just as a snack. Leave all the sugar off and you can use it to flavor all of your different vegetables and even gumbo. I've seen it in putting gumbos in stews and all of these wonderful things. So, y'all, sugar cane season, Michelle. I might mention you want to throw some sugar cane on it as well as we used to do. Anyway, y'all, thank you so much for being with us and support all of your Native American cultures out there, or all of your cultures in general. They all have great stories to tell, and they're willing to help to preserve their cultures, and they need you to listen to their stories. We'll see you next week.
From Scotland, Ireland, North America, and even further afield, bask in the glow of my selection of new music from Celtic Roots this week on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday evening at 6, right here on KRVS.
Tune in to the Diamond Sea every Saturday night at midnight for a mixtape of classic and contemporary independent music here on listener-supported 88.7 FM KRVS, public radio for Acadiana.
Hi, this is Nick Forster. Every week in E-Town, we bring together musicians from a wide range of styles for some great live performances and conversation. And we also present the Achievement Award to someone doing outstanding work in their communities. It's an hour of uplifting stories and music each week on E-Town.
Tuesday at noon on KRVS.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, online at krvs.com.